Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Reen, but she's going to be back on Monday, and she's very anxious to be back with all of you, her loyal listeners. Congressional Democrats unite behind the health care plan outlined by President Obama at a joint session of Congress on Wednesday. The Census Bureau reports the nation's poverty rate rose last year, while employer-provided health insurance and coverage for adults also declined. And a year after Lehman Brothers collapsed, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says the U.S. economy is no longer on the brink of disaster, but it still has a, quote, long way to go to recover. Joining me for the domestic portion of our Friday News Roundup, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Jackie Combs of the New York Times, and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good to be with you.
Good morning.
You can join our conversation, as always, 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org, or you can reach us on Facebook, Twitter, and smoke signals, and just about every other form of communication. Let's talk about the president's speech briefly. I want each of you to give me a sense of what we've had a couple of days to digest this now. Jackie, what's the most important thing you heard?
Well, I heard less detail than I expected, but I guess for the long run, the most important thing is that he, with an audience, I mean, he was speaking to the American public, but he also had the liberal Democrats in front of him that dominate in the House. And he made clear that while he likes to have a public option in this exchange of insurance offerings that he wants to create for the uninsured, that he's not wedded to that, and he's open to alternatives.
What did you take away, Byron?
I thought it was a highly partisan speech, filled with frustrations, suggesting that, you know, the time to talk is coming to a close, the kind of threat to use the Democrats' very large majorities to get this passed anyway, and directed at really rallying the Democrats, because so many of the stories going into it had been about nervous House Democrats.
Even though he mentioned at least three Republicans by name, Senators McCain, Grassley, and
he did indeed, but he didn't really sell them. For example, on the tort reform thing, setting up kind of a model project to see that, it's not something that Republicans reacted to, who have submitted many bills of their own addressing tort reform. It's not something that will win, I think, any Republican support.
EJ, what's your take?
I think after a summer in which he was kind of listless and laid back, he joined the fight. And I think that for Democrats, both the moderates and the liberals, the fact that he joined the fight, that he said he wouldn't, if you misrepresent what's in the plan, we will call you out. I will not waste time with those who have made the calculation that it's better politics to kill this plan than improve it. That kind of language, I think, appealed across the board to Democrats.
So you kind of agree with Byron that it was a fairly partisan.
Well, I don't agree with Byron, because if you looked at the actual content, this was a moderate speech, because he was saying, I'm for the public plan. He made a good case for it, but he said, I'm willing to compromise. He cut the amount in the bill from over $1 trillion to $90 million a year, which I worry a little bit about whether that's going to cover everybody, although if you get almost there, you'll probably finish the job eventually. So that and he mentioned Republicans a lot. I thought it was fascinating that he used Ted Kennedy's friendships with Republicans to say nice things about a whole bunch of Republicans.
He mentioned more Republicans by name than Democrats.
Exactly right. So he was tough. I mean, he had been beaten around the head all summer by Republicans. And I think a lot of people said, president looks weak if he doesn't fight back. So he fought back, but in the name of a moderate bill.
Now, Jackie, looking forward here, situation on Capitol Hill. Did this speech change anything? How would you describe the dynamic now, post-speech?
It's not, I don't think it changed a lot. I think, you know, I hate to say that his speech changed less than perhaps the outburst from a particular Republican in the audience and the catcalls of some others in unifying the Democrats. But I think the Democrats' disunity was already overstated even before the speech. I think that there is, in the end, a feeling that will carry the day that passing something, and don't ask me to define something, is better than doing nothing, because they did that in 1994, and they subsequently lost their majorities in Congress in the coming election.
And Byron, one of the truths you mentioned, there are large Democratic majorities. But in addition to that, every Democrat on Capitol Hill has a certain vested interest in Barack Obama's success. This is his first really big test. And do you agree with Jackie that in the end that dynamic will bring enough Democrats together to pass a bill?
It's entirely possible. There are 256 Democrats in the House, and the Progressive Caucus is over 80 people, I think, the biggest caucus. And the White House is betting, and I think correctly, that regardless of what happens on the public option, they're ultimately going to come around and support their team. So I think it is a real possibility that that will happen. The bigger problem, I think, for Obama is we should say it was a well-delivered speech. It was an effective performance, and I think he'll get a temporary bump out of it. The problem, though, is that the facts on the ground haven't changed. The Washington Post has a story this morning, details still lacking on Obama's proposal. Administration officials struggled to detail how he would achieve his goal of extending coverage to tens of millions without increasing the deficit. That hasn't changed.
Do you see any possibility that any Republicans will come along?
Well, there's continual hope for Olympia Snowe of Maine in the Senate, but I mean, when you're talking about possibly winning a single Republican vote in the Senate, there's no way that you can characterize that as bipartisan.
Although when you have 59 votes, one vote is important to get you to 60.
Well, it depends on whether they go the so-called reconciliation route. But talking to members of the House yesterday, I didn't see any move among any Republicans.
But there really hasn't been for a while.
No.
But you can't have a bipartisan bill if the other party has decided it just won't play. And I think that was the significance of Obama sort of calling Republicans out and saying, look, you know, Chuck Grassley in the Senate was negotiating with Max Baucus for months. Max Baucus desperately wanted to bring Republicans along. Obama all summer really ignored his left and spent all his time trying to win moderates, and he got his left pretty angry at him. And if after all that you can't get any Republicans to come along, you just have to go with the Republican Party you have, not the one you wish were there.
But
and so I think that, you know, part of the fight after this, if people are going to talk about bipartisanship, is, well, who tried hardest? And that's why Obama still kept at it in the context of this fighting speech.
But isn't one of the truths here that there are not that many moderate Republicans left? I mean, you talk about Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins from Maine, but Arlen Specter is now a Democrat.
Longer.
And when you talk about, in the context of the Senate, when you look at people like Chuck Grassley of Iowa and Mike Enzi of Wyoming and describe them as moderates, you know, the whole northeastern New York, New Jersey, upper Midwest tradition of moderate Republicanism has been virtually eliminated from the Senate.
Republicans have virtually disappeared from the Northeast. There's no doubt about it. But there is no obligation for Republicans to play on this particular bill. I spent a long time yesterday talking to Representative Tom Price, Georgia Representative Republican, who's also an orthopedic surgeon, talking about the 30-plus bills that Republicans have introduced in the House dealing with portability, cost, pre-existing conditions, all the basic things that people are most concerned about, health care.
By extension, if there's no obligation for Republicans to play, there's no obligation
bill.
For Democrats to play with people who don't want to play.
Let me talk about substance here. Jackie, you said you can't predict what's going to be in the bill. I understand that. But give us a sense of the emerging consensus. The focus on the differences, like the public option, in some ways has hidden the fact that there is actually consensus on a lot of elements.
Yeah.
What are those core elements that you expect to see in a bill?
Well, I think it's and we should say at the outset that this is really, for all of the noise, this is really a moderate package. I don't think and you know, Byron suggests a lot of what he suggests are Republican bills are going to be part of this. You have on the outside looking in two former Republican Senate majority leaders, Howard Baker and Robert Dole, who with former Democratic leader Tom Daschle have put out a plan that has a lot of the same elements. And what are those elements? Well, you're going to have expanded for the uninsured, about 15% of the population, depending on how you cut it, expanded Medicaid and new subsidies, tax credits for both individuals to buy insurance in this new exchange they'll create with a menu of options, private and, you know, perhaps public, but I would doubt it. And you would have, for small businesses who want to cover their employees, to come in and also buy from this market. The advantage of this exchange is it pools the risks to create more affordable insurance.
And there'll be insurance reform, too, in terms of saying you can't drop coverage if you get sick and those kinds of issues.
And while the whole drive to cover the uninsured millions in America has always sort of been what the liberals want. In fact, what's politically what they politically want to do is appeal to the 85% who already have insurance with these reforms you're talking about.
Now, let me ask you quickly, Jackie, you brought up the question, Byron, of Congressman Joe Wilson of South Carolina. Got a lot of attention when he screamed, "You lie," to the president. He then apologized, but he also was reflecting a widespread anger on the Republican side. Give me your take on what Wilson signifies.
Well, first of all, he should have apologized, and he did, although he did it after the House Republican leadership leaned on him big time in the moments after the president's speech. But he does reflect. He yelled at the president after the president had said two things. He had said that Republican concerns that they're somehow going to have panels to kill grandma are a lie, plain and simple, and that they will cover illegal immigrants is also false. And that's when he yelled out, "You lie."
We should reinforce that point. The president used the word lie, too.
That's
correct. He wasn't the only person to use it.
I think the president did not actually elevate the discourse.
He didn't accuse a person.
He said these stories are a lie, which they are, about the death panels.
I think the president was not really elevating the discourse, but there's no excuse for Wilson yelling out like that. However, a lot of Republicans feel that this is actually, in a boomerang kind of way, brought attention to this issue. There is a story in the Washington Post today called "Shout Draws Focus to Illegal Immigrant Issue," in which the Post writer concludes that the truth is somewhere between Obama and Joe Wilson.
But Jackie, you say that he also unified the Democrats. He's had that effect.
He absolutely has, because they, figure if a president of the United States is going to get that kind of treatment on the floor of the House. And, you know, Steve, you and I covering Congress go back a quarter century. And so we've seen a lot of arguments, but there's always a civility.
That's Jackie Combs, New York Times, E.J. Dion of The Post, Byron York of The Washington Examiner. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. We'll be back with your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and with me for the first hour of our Friday News Roundup, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Jackie Combs of the New York Times, E.J. Dion of the Washington Post. E.J., let's pick up on this story of Joe Wilson, the congressman from South Carolina. In addition to the short term, there was long term or larger implications here about the way Americans talk about politics these days. We've gone through a summer of people shouting at town hall meetings, cable TV and talk radio filled with people who think that the way to talk about politics is to yell as loud as you can and never listen to anybody else. Give me your take on the significance of this outburst.
Well, there's something really disturbing about Barack Obama being president for only 200 days, and already you have people like Rush Limbaugh defending Wilson, saying that Obama's trying to tear down our traditions and institutions. 200 days in office, a relatively moderate liberal, and they're saying these things. I think that's very disturbing, although it's not surprising. Father Coughlin went after FDR. Joe Welch of the John Birch Society said that Eisenhower was a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy. I think now these guys have cable shows and talk radio shows, and they are louder. It should disturb us that Wilson was yelling at Obama. It wasn't really about the death penalty. It was about illegal immigration. And the notion that one or two or a handful of illegal immigrants might sneak through these terribly tough rules they put and get health care, and that we're going to get really upset about that. They've got very tough rules in this bill to prevent illegal immigrants from getting health care.
But this also comes, Jackie, after the birther movement, which has questioned his legitimacy as a U.S. citizen, the whole flap, which petered out a little bit about his speech to school children, where the Florida Republican leader said he accused him of spreading socialism when he went to made a speech to say, you know, work hard and stay in school. Are we seeing an attitude toward the president reflected in some of these comments from his most ardent critics?
Well, yeah, you know, you can go back to the campaign when he was attacked as a socialist, and there was this undercurrent that he's somehow alien. And, of course, there were some who would go so far as to suggest, and that, and not without grounds, that there was a race element to this. And I think that's what, you know, there's not a lot of attention to this, but Republicans still say that they want to be a more diverse party, and they do want to reach out to African-Americans. But you're picking up a lot of sense, given that it is so early in this president's administration, that that from African Americans that they're talking like this to him because he's a black president.
Interesting. Byron, I want your take, but let me mention that I was struck in looking at the photograph of Joe Wilson taken as he was yelling, and he was totally surrounded by white men. This was the Republican Party represented in the House of Representatives. As Jackie points out, Democrats have profited politically by becoming a more diverse party. Only 36% of the electorate in the last election were white men, and only 28% were white men over 30. Is this a problem for the Republicans?
Well, a lot of Republicans have been working for quite a long time, unsuccessfully so far, to try to expand their base. I'd have two reactions to this. One, discourse in the House and in the Congress in general has not always been so civil. Democrats they booed quite loudly at George Bush in a joint session of Congress. But two, about Obama being in office such a short time, I think even people who are sympathetic to the president are worried that he's tried to overload the system, that he did come into office in an emergency, but after the stimulus, after the budget, after the takeover of the automakers, after cap and trade, and now health care. And the president has redefined. People wanted the president to do something about the economic emergency. He did. And then he redefined recovery to include his agenda from the 2008 Democratic primaries. And he has overloading the system, and it's not surprising that people would get agitated.
But there is no excuse for that doesn't create an excuse for the birthers or carrying guns to rallies or calling them a socialist. It's legitimate to argue about is this too much or not, but this is beyond the normal bounds of our usual political debate.
Well, you know, the president himself began to describe the healthcare rallies, healthcare town halls, as a healthy exercise in democracy. After the administration began to sort of attack the people who were yelling or the birthers, they pulled back and actually began to describe these events as healthy events. The president in his two town halls said that very thing.
Most of them were, actually. The people yelling got a lot more media attention than all the other people who had thoughtful things on both sides to say.
Jackie, I want you to pick up on you cover economics from the New York Times, and there's a very important series of numbers out this week showing significant changes in poverty rate that really moved sharply from 12.5% to 13.2%, highest poverty rate since 1997. Number of uninsured increased by about 500,000, and the median income, meaning the income by the family, this is an exact middle of the country, actually declined by $1,800. So Obama himself cited some of these figures in arguing for health care reform. What's your take, the significance of these numbers?
Well, they are significant, and what's they represent a trend that we already knew has been underway for this entire decade. And what's worse is these numbers are actually, in reality, probably worse because much of the data was collected before the economy really turned downward this year. And so the number of people, you know, in terms of income and people who've lost insurance and poverty by virtue of just the great job loss we've seen this year, you can bet that these numbers are worse than what we're seeing.
I think that's absolutely right. And my colleague at the Brookings Institution, Bill Galson, made a good point yesterday when he said that we have a lot to worry about over at least the next year, because you're also seeing a decline in the number of hours worked, which mm-hmm. means a lot of employers, when things start getting better, are going to be able to just give people more hours and not hire new people. The unemployment numbers may actually go up, because if the economy gets better, people who have given up looking for work may re-enter the ranks of those seeking it without actually getting
and
jobs.
If you talk about the real underemployment number, that is people who are working part-time or fewer hours than they want, it's really up to about 16-17% of the people of the workforce that is underemployed, if not unemployed.
Right, and both substantively and politically, when you think about, we have the midterm elections in November of 2010, the numbers, we may start growing again, but numbers on unemployment and other measures that average people use to judge the economy could still be pretty bad.
And Byron, there were also the Fed, Federal Reserve this week in one of its periodic reports, it described the economy as improving but still fragile, and most economic indicators are still very mixed.
Prior to its regular meetings, the Fed does an assessment of the economy, and this latest assessment found modest improvements in the manufacturing sector, retail activity flat, housing market a little better, job market weak, banking sector disaster. They did not find a good picture. They called it a mixed picture, but it is bad. Unemployment now at 9.7, still likely to go up a little more, and I agree with EJ. I think that's a potentially devastating factor in the politics of 2010.
Because, Jackie, the Republican argument has been repeatedly this is a jobless recovery,
right.
And this week also, the first anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers and sort of the acute start of the financial crisis. And the administration argued, Christina Romer, the chief economic advisor, said, well, we saved or created a million jobs. Others said maybe it's 600,000. But no matter what they argue, there's still a sense in this country that a lot of people are hurting and a lot of people are still looking for work that they can't find.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when you get the numbers for August that we've lost 216,000 jobs, and that's treated as good news because it's a lot less than the 700,000 in January, shows you how hard things are. And it's the administration can argue how many jobs have been created by the Stimulus and Recovery Act, because you can't disprove them. Those numbers it's just impossible to know.
Yeah.
And at the same time,
I mean, to say it would have been worse, right. How do you measure that?
Yeah. At the same time, I think the Republican attacks on that are somewhat disingenuous, given that just about every impartial observer of the economy that I've either read or talked to agrees that this stimulus was necessary and things would be worse had it not been enacted.
And there's an interesting thing about the stimulus, which is that it was criticized at the time, in some ways legitimately, for backloading too much of its spending. But given where the economy is now, the notion that it will be pumping quite a bit of money into the economy over the next year could actually make it a helpful thing. I mean, the problem Obama has is he, along, it should be said, with Bush at the end of his term, when he was willing to throw all this money at the banks, there were a lot of problems with that, but it probably helped prevent a collapse. And Obama continued and really helped prevent a complete collapse. Nobody gives you credit for preventing a collapse.
How do you prove it? How do you prove that? And Byron, as you point out, Republicans are focusing on what's clearly the weakest argument for the Democrats, which is jobs.
And the bigger picture is, when does Obama come to own the economy? He obviously inherited a horrific mess. He could say reasonably for many months that he did inherit that. But at some point, certainly before the midterm elections, this will be seen as his economy. Ronald Reagan, who also inherited a mess, was in the 60s in his first couple of months in office, And a year later, after unemployment had gone up quite a bit in the fall of 1981, I think was at 45-46, positive negative.
And the Republicans lost 26 seats in the 82 election.
But they held and you know, the Reagan analogy actually wouldn't be so bad for Obama, because when you think about it, unemployment hit 10% right before the 82 elections, and the Republicans still managed to hold on to the House and the Senate. Their losses were much less than the Democrats expected the Republican losses to be. So there will be some losses, but it's a question of how much.
Let me ask you another couple of quick questions. We'll get to our callers, Jackie. In the with the death of Ted Kennedy, the second senior senator in the entire body. A lot of movement with other senators taking his old jobs. And you had Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut, who's clearly in trouble in his reelection bid. Instead of taking over the health committee that Kennedy's death vacated, he chose to stay on the banking committee and shepherd what will be an overhaul of banking and financial regulations down the road. What's your take on the significance of Senator Dodd's decision?
Well, that was a surprise to people. There was most people thinking that he would take over Ted Kennedy's committee, if only for, you know, nostalgic reasons, and by staying at bank, and that he had, you know, he's tried to take the lead role that Ted Kennedy would have played on that committee for shepherding health care through the Senate. But at the same time, at banking, he's had his hands full for obvious reasons, and for the future, in trying to shepherd a financial, re-regulating the financial regulatory system. And but you know, there's got to be a heavy element of this is where the money is. If you're the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, you can draw a lot of campaign contributions.
And if you're the senator from Connecticut with a lot of insurance companies,
yes,
in your state. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. EJ, tell us about Tom Harkin, who is the senator from Iowa, who will take over the health committee. Been around a long time.
He's a prairie populist. He's very progressive in a fairly conservative state, but he hangs on because he's got a persona that fits very well with a rural constituency. He's plain talking. He ran for president, lost, but ran, you know, a campaign that a lot of people respected. He's going to be, I think, a smart sort of liberal. And I put it that way because I think he's a liberal who knows how to make an argument to people who aren't liberals.
One of the things about Tom Harkin's background, he was a pilot in Vietnam. He wasn't a combat pilot, but he flew missions as a transport pilot and remains a pilot himself. And he has always had that dimension of his background that has made him more popular in a conservative state.
That's right. And he's somebody who's been vulnerable election after election, and he keeps surviving.
And he's also the chairmship of the Agriculture Committee.
Which is always pretty important.
When you're in Iowa, if you're chairman of the Agricultural Committee, you have some mojo.
One other thing I want to ask you about, Jackie. We mentioned the death of Ted Kennedy and his absence as chairman of that committee. But one of the things that struck me when you look down the line, as you all seem to agree, there will be a bill of some sort which will fall short of the ideals that a lot of liberals want. At that moment, if Ted Kennedy were alive, he would be the one who would go to the liberals and say, this is the best we can get, and sell it. Is his absence going to be felt here in terms of the end game on health care?
I think his absence has been most felt in this point up to now. If he, you know, the fact that Senator Baucus at the Finance Committee and has taken this long to put together an agreement in his committee, I think, and Senator Ted Kennedy's committee, or the committee he would have been leading, has one that's very much liberal, there would have been, not that it would have been a different product, but I think Senator Kennedy would have been working some more with Senator Baucus, and this, we might have had some action sooner than this, if only the competition between the two senators. But in the end, I think the letter from Senator Kennedy that President Obama read in his speech on Wednesday night, that the senator asked be delivered to the president after he had died, will be used as effectively, if not more so, than Senator Kennedy's own presence in arguing to liberals, we have to get this.
And it was noticeable that despite the raucous period that preceded that, the chamber felt dead silence when he talked about Ted Kennedy.
No, that's absolutely right. And you know, what was fascinating is Ted Kennedy is still with us. He managed with two letters, one to the Pope, which was read right at his grave before he was put in the ground, and then this letter to Barack Obama. He has kept himself in the political debate even after he's gone to his eternal reward. And Barack Obama used Kennedy to deliver the most substantive defense of government and liberalism he has ever offered as president.
Byron, quickly, another major event this week, overshadowed by the speech, was the argument in the Supreme Court. Unusual argument a month before the normal opening of the court, re-arguing a case with major potential implications for the political system. Give us a quick summary here.
The conservative majority on the court has wanted for a long time to revisit the campaign finance laws and at least take apart parts of McCain-Feingold. At issue here is a movie about
Feingold,
Hillary.
McCain-Feingold being the basic structure of the campaign
finance reform, right. Yes. The issue here is a movie about Hillary Clinton that was produced by a conservative group called Citizens United and before in the 2008 season, and whether corporate funding of that should be prohibited in the period leading up to election. And the basic issue is what it's always been, which is conservatives say in politics, spending money is the equivalent of speech,
free speech.
And should be protected.
But quickly, historically, contributions by corporations have been banned in this country for a century. But there is a potential here for the court to change some very basic regulations.
It's entirely possible. We don't know how they're going to vote. I mean, we can just hear what they said in the arguments. But Justice Anthony Kennedy, for example, seemed very hostile to the idea.
That's Byron York of The Washington Examiner. Also with me, Jackie Combs of The New York Times, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane. And when we come back, we're going to open the phones for your calls and your comments. So stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. British-led troops in Afghanistan rescue an American journalist held by the Taliban, but his interpreter was killed in the effort. Iran rejects any compromise over its nuclear program. And a suicide truck bomber hits a Kurdish village in northern Iraq, killing at least 20 people. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane, and as always on our Friday News Roundup first hour on domestic policy, Jackie Combs of the New York Times covers economics, and Capitol Hill is with me, E.J. Dionne, who writes column for the Washington Post, and Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. We got a lot of emails on one subject, which is exactly what the president said about illegal immigrants. And was Joe Wilson right or was the president right? Here's Lee from Birmingham. Please, please, please clear up the question of whether the president's illegal immigrant health coverage statement Wednesday night is a lie, a half lie, or the truth. Where does the—and we have Colleen from Dallas. I can't believe my ears. The The bill specifically prohibits covering those who are in this country illegally. That is what Obama said, so he did not lie. We owe you to your listeners to correct us. Jackie, what is your best take on this subject?
The bills do specifically rule out getting having aid go to illegal immigrants. What people are seizing on to say otherwise is something that's true of just about any legislation, that there are ways for people who are currently in this country illegally to get aid, either through a family member, perhaps, or, there are ways that you can sneak through. There aren't very many, though, because the facts of the matter are that illegal immigrants do not like to intersect with the system for fear of being turned in. And there's another thing that people forget is the courts have ruled in the past, there is a federal law that requires hospital emergency rooms to treat people. These sort of things are happening now, and money is being used for illegal immigrants. But the bill would not change that.
Byron, would you add anything on that point?
Well, first of all, I just happen to have what the president said. He said, yep, there are those also who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally. The Republican argument is, much of the bill is just silent on the issue of illegal immigrants, but more importantly, that even where there are prohibitions, that there are no enforcement mechanisms in there. It is against the law to run the stop sign down the street, but if there is no enforcement at all of it and no mechanism, no police force, then it really doesn't matter.
But the fact is the bill is very clear in not wanting to extend these benefits to illegal immigrants, so that what the president said is true. Is it possible that some tiny number of illegal immigrants will get through some screen? Well, sure, it's possible. There are all kinds of things that are possible. But to say that this bill is designed to cover illegal immigrants, he didn't lie.
Okay, let's go to here's an email from Gary in San Antonio. He says, David Brooks, our old friend, stated on Wednesday night that today's Congress lacks the skilled legislators that LBJ had when he was trying to get Medicare passed. Is this due to the influence of the far wings of their respective parties? Does a modern Congress have any hope of getting something of this magnitude passed now or in the future? Is the legislative system broken? EJ, what do you think?
Well, David's my friend, and I like him very much, but I also don't trust nostalgia about how great people were 30 years ago compared to where we are now. I think it has much more to do with polarization in the political system. You said it right earlier, I thought, Steve, when you noted that the Republican Party is far more ideological than it was in 1965. You don't have Mac Mathias, Clifford Case, Jacob Javits. These were genuinely liberal or progressive
Republicans. Warren Rudman,
Republicans.
John Danforth, Mark right. Hatfield, Bob and Packwood. It's a very, very long list.
So it's a very different political situation. There were great people back then, but there are some pretty decent legislators around now.
Byron,
oh, absolutely.
I believe that in the 1960s, Democrats had 68 members of the Senate. You can get stuff done even more easily with 68 members of the Senate. They had huge majorities in the House.
And they had, and a lot of them were conservative Southern Democrats.
They were.
And it's not just a loss of progressive Republicans. It's a loss of conservative Democrats that combine to hollow out the middle of the
country. Brooks was talking about the extremes of both parties,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, what we have in this country now, I think, is there is a real danger of dysfunctional government insofar as Congress is concerned, because I see it as a process of computer precision in redistricting, gerrymandering of districts, that has the extremes of both parties getting elected to these districts and a very, very small middle in swing districts. And then, as this has happened over since, I'd say, the 1990 redistricting, you've had this farm club of members of Republicans in particular that were in the House, were part of the Gingrich Revolution, are quite confrontational and ideological, and they have graduated to the Senate, so that you now have a lot of these former House members in the Senate.
Let's read this email from Glenn from Ann Arbor. We must have heard two different speeches, he writes. I heard President Obama commit to a public option, even if only 5% of the population use it. Did you hear that, EJ?
That was the beauty of what he said.
I think, first of all, just one more thing on the Senate. We didn't have the abuse of the filibuster that we have now. We've created this artificial 60-vote
right.
majority on everything. The president made a great case for the public option. He said why he's for it, why he thinks it would be good in the bill. Then he said, but this should not be the centerpiece of our efforts, and he's prepared to listen to other proposals. What his concern is that he can't quite get the votes necessary to pass a right. bill that has a public option because some moderate Democrats, for various reasons, are uncomfortable with it. I think what they're going to end up with is a triggered public option. That is to say, it will come into being if the insurance companies don't provide alternatives.
And since the speech, Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, have both taken a somewhat more moderate line, not drawing a line in the sand, not committing, as Glenn says, to this as a deal breaker.
Right. And I think that Nancy Pelosi wants to get a bill through the House that has a public option in it. And she will get a bill through the House with a trigger if that's the concession she needs to get to 218 right. votes.
But Max Baucus, chairman of the Finance Committee, came out and said a bill with a public option cannot pass the Senate. Well, it was as clear as you can
And Max
be.
Baucus isn't alone in the Senate in saying that. I mean, the calculus—
Ken Conrad has said the same
right.
thing.
The calculus is very simple legislatively. The House cannot pass a bill without a public option. The Senate cannot pass one with it. So they go to conference committee, and there mostly is a sense that the bigger imperative is to get a bill through the Senate because it's harder to get bills through there. The House Democrats have rules that can control action. So they'll compromise in a way that pleases the Senate.
I'd feel a lot better, though, if some of these moderate Democrats, instead of hiding behind the phrase, it won't pass the Senate, said whether they're right. for the public option or not. I think Kate Conrad finally said he's against it, but I think that's a dodge by them.
But Byron, there's one other dimension of this debate that we have not touched on, which is how to pay for it. And the president said he would veto a bill that was not right. deficit neutral. He didn't say he'd use a veto if it didn't, if it lacked a public option. He did use that threat. When you get to specifics, we hear phrases like squeezing out waste, fraud, and abuse. And there are a lot of Democrats who, when Ronald Reagan used those phrases, were very suspicious. And now the shoe is on the other foot.
This drives Republicans crazy. The president wants to pay for a large portion of his plan by cutting $500 billion out of Medicare over the next 10 years. I've talked with Republicans who were in the House and the Senate in the 1990s, where Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole proposed cutting the rate of growth of Medicare and just got killed by President Clinton and the Democrats. There were demonstrations. Now the president says there are, quote, efficiencies and savings to be found in these systems to that tune. It is simply not possible to cut $500 billion out of Medicare over the 10 years and not affect coverage.
Let's go to some. We want to get to some of our callers and give them a chance here. And Mark in Oklahoma City, you're on the Diane Rehm Show. Welcome.
Well, thank you. What I heard from the president's speech Wednesday night and my takeaway was that in contrast to what President Obama said when he was running for president, that he did not support mandates along the lines of the Massachusetts Health Reform Plan, where you're required to buy mm-hmm. private for-profit health insurance, where you'll be fine, now he is supporting that. And also, it seems to me like he's essentially starting to endorse the concept of expanding the Massachusetts health care plan nationally, which is ironic on many levels, one of them being that Mitt Romney was the Republican governor that signed it into law and still defends it. And it's my understanding, and I don't live in Massachusetts, that there's a public option in the Massachusetts plan called Commonwealth Care, ironically enough. And I'm still thinking that from what I understand, the Massachusetts plan not only it's increased the amount of people that are covered because they're fined if they don't buy it. If they can't afford it, then it's subsidized, but it has not been controlling costs because it doesn't address the central issue of rising health care costs, which is profiteering among health insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and doctors and hospitals.
Okay, Mark, a lot of good points. Thanks for your call. Jackie, deal with the first one about has the president changed on the issue of mandates?
He's said all along that he wants this was an issue during the presidential campaign with Hillary Clinton as well, that employer mandates and individual mandates as well. I mean, remember back in the mid-90s when Bill Clinton attempted this, that was the big the sword that a lot of Democrats were falling on, that they wanted it to be employer mandates, not individual mandates. And now there's a recognition that you need to have individual mandates as well.
EJ, quickly, your take on the Massachusetts plan, your home state.
First, I think he has changed his position on mandates. He might call Mrs. Clinton and say, well, maybe you were right about that after all. And on the Massachusetts plan, first, Mitt Romney doesn't defend it anymore. It's one of the interesting things about Republican politics that it was a great achievement that he claims no credit
for. He said it was
a
good idea when he did it.
Right. And then, but now he doesn't really defend what they did. The fact is Massachusetts set up a system that did increase the number of insured. It's very expensive. It is hard for a state all by itself to control costs. So there's been some real successes in Massachusetts. It still needs work. And I think what that tells us is healthcare reform isn't one bill. It's going to be a long process.
Let me turn to Robert in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Steve. I'm calling for a couple of reasons. I just got an email 2 days before Obama spoke from James Dobson in Colorado Springs, said that we must defeat Obama's health care reform because tax dollars will be used to fund abortions. I'm calling because folks like Rush Limbaugh and Newt Gingrich and many at Fox News are saying that we must defeat Obama's health care reform because there are not adequate provisions to stop frivolous lawsuits. Now, here in Texas, if you have a massive malignancy in your breast or leg, and they inadvertently cut off a healthy limb or the healthy organ, the most you can collect in Texas for pain and suffering is $250,000. The problem is those savings for the insurance companies and the medical profession are not passed on to patients because we still have the highest patient care costs in the country. And if you lump all the costs of litigation, you're only talking about less than half of 1% of total medical care costs.
Thank you so much for your call. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Byron, let's deal with the first issue. A lot of conservatives say that in addition to the arguments over illegal immigrants being eligible, the other hot-button issue for a lot of conservatives is this bill would somehow finance abortions. What's your fairest take on that?
I believe the worry is about what's not in the bill, as far as abortion is concerned, that if without specific prohibitions, if you give discretion to this health administrator or this health committee czar, then later regulations will involve the funding of abortion. So like illegal immigration, there's a lot that's not said in these bills, and that what we'll have to see what actually happens if they were passed and go into practice.
The administration is in very intense negotiations with pro-lifers to try to figure out how to strengthen the language on abortion. That's why the president said flatly this won't increase the number of abortions. It's hard to do when you are subsidizing large parts of the health care system, but they are determined to try to get this issue off the table.
And Jackie, the second issue that our caller raised about medical malpractice, right. The president himself use this as a way of reaching out to Republicans.
Right.
This has been a very important issue to many Republicans, saying that reforming the medical malpractice system is an essential element
right.
of controlling costs. Give us your take and your answer to
the caller raised a very important point to be made, and not to diminish the impact that limiting tort lawsuits would have in reducing medical costs. Because there's little question that there is a lot of defensive medicine being practiced. That said, the callers from Texas, states like Texas and Mississippi that used to be trial lawyers' playgrounds, now have passed tort reform laws that, and a number of states have, that have essentially done this through the states. And you haven't seen, there have been studies now of in the wake of those state laws, and there hasn't, like the suggested, there hasn't been any big discernible pass-through in savings to employers or individuals, and there hasn't been a reduction in costs in those states.
But what significance, EJ, did you read into the president's statement in raising the issue of medical malpractice?
I think he was throwing a sort of a bipartisan sort of flower at the Republicans. He said very explicitly that fixing the malpractice system will not have nearly the effect that Republicans say. He didn't say it quite that way, but that's what he said. And he said, let's have these demonstration studies to figure out how much the lawsuits cost.
But in fairness, Jackie raises the trial lawyers. Democrats very vocal in opposing the special interests. Big drug companies, big insurance companies. But they have their own special interests, the trial lawyers who pay an enormous amount of money into Democratic coffers, and they have their own special interests to pay attention to.
Actually, there are some Republican senators who get a lot of money from trial lawyers, too. But, you know, the trial lawyers, yes, are an interest. They tend to be aligned against corporate interests. Nick Lemon now of the Columbia Journalism School wrote something very interesting where he said in the Northeast, unions were the folks who played the populist role. In the South, it's the trial lawyers suing the big companies who play that role, but they get very rich in the process. It's
very
true.
Quickly, got a minute, Jackie. What's going to happen now? When do you expect to see a bill? Will there be a bill? When do you expect to see it?
Well, first we have to see what comes out of the Senate Finance Committee, whether Senator Baucus can get even the semblance of bipartisanship. The House, you know, the three House committees have all produced their bill. They're working together, but there's not going to be House action. They want to see what the Senate's going to do. The Democrats in the House do not want to vote for something that then becomes a dead letter because the Senate, you know, is seen as the biggest influence on this.
Byron, is it going to be a bill on the president's desk by the end of the year?
I don't think so. I think the headline of what Jackie was saying is that the process is going to slow down. And it's inevitably got to slow down because of these internal contradictions in the bill that can't be worked out. You can't extend this much coverage and reduce the deficit. You just can't do it.
There will be a bill.
There will be a bill?
Yes, and I think they are before the end of the year because I think Democrats know that they have to get this done. If it goes into next year, it won't happen.
That's E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, Jackie Combs of The New York Times, Byron York of The Washington Examiner. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. She is going to be back on Monday, but I'm grateful for you for spending your Friday morning with us. Thanks a lot.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.